Welcome to In My Backyard, an open conversation about children and mental health. We all know a child who's struggling, whether that child tells us or not. In this podcast, we speak with experts on the many factors of emotional distress in children, how to address those factors, and how to create a community where all children can be healthy and happy. This podcast is made possible through generous donations from supporters and listeners like you. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Your host is Tricia Costales, CEO of the Guidance Center.
I'm Tricia Costales, your host of In My Backyard. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the chief executive officer of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency serving 3,500 children and families every year. We spoke in prior episodes about the prevalence of psychological distress amongst our children and some of the factors that negatively influence well-being. Today we're going to discuss what happens in a real-life psychiatric crisis and the perhaps inappropriate demands these calls place on law enforcement and other first responders. As reported by the National Association of Social Workers, police respond to an average of 240 million 911 calls a year. Conservatively, at least 10% of these calls involve a person with a serious mental illness experiencing a psychiatric crisis. The Treatment Advocacy Center further reports that these calls make up a disproportionate 25% of fatal police encounters. Speaking specifically to children, the Los Angeles Unified School District was the focus of an alarming case study by Eliana Edwards of UCLA. The district increased funding for school police from 2010 to 2019 by 48%, although the student enrollment decreased by 18%. During that same period, critical incidents on school campuses, including suicidal threats, increased by 906%. These statistics all beg the question, is law enforcement the most appropriate and best response to nonviolent psychiatric emergencies that might be better suited to social work? In today's podcast, we're going to speak with retired Detective 3 Charles Dempsey of the LAPD. A psychiatric nurse in a prior life, Detective Dempsey was most recently the officer in charge of the training detail, Crisis Response Support Section of the department. The LAPD has a model mental evaluations unit that includes a multi-layered approach to responding to incidents involving the mentally ill, including children. This includes trained dispatchers, mental health professionals who respond to calls with a police partner, case management, and a robust mental health training requirement for all LAPD officers, which was overseen by Detective Dempsey. Even in retirement, Detective Dempsey remains a leader in the conversation on the overlap between mental health and law enforcement. We're lucky to chat with him today. So welcome, Charles. Thank you for joining us today. I have the great benefit of knowing you from our collaboration together on developing training for first responders for law enforcement. But for our audience, will you please share a little bit about yourself?
I'm a 30-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department. For the last 15-plus years during my tenure there, I was fortunate to be selected the officer in charge of what the department calls their mental evaluation unit. This unit had been around for a number of years, since the early 90s, but I had an opportunity to bring the unit into a situation where they were much more responsive to the crisis calls for service. And prior to being a law enforcement officer, I worked and was a charge nurse in a lockdown psychiatric unit. So what was beneficial for me was I was able to walk in both worlds. I could talk with the folks from the Department of Mental Health, talk to families in crisis, but also speak in that law enforcement language in order to get everybody to partner up and cooperate.
I think that's that unique background is definitely a strength of yours. When we met, the thing that struck me most is although you were in law enforcement, you're clearly a mental health advocate as well. And I thought that was a pretty powerful combination. So I do think we're very lucky to have you here today. So as a mental health provider myself, I have had countless interactions with law enforcement when we needed help in psychiatrically hospitalizing a child who was unsafe. And I live in LA County, a county that's greatly impacted by the homeless mentally ill crisis. Still, I really didn't understand the scope of the burden placed on law enforcement to respond to these crises until I started collaborating with you and your team. So I'd like to hear from you, from your decades in law enforcement. Please speak to us about how the burden of mental health calls has changed over time and what impact this has had on policing.
Well, you know, the first thing is this is not new to law enforcement. We can go back. I actually found training bulletins, which are documents that the department publishes for officers to orient them to different issues, whether it's writing a citation, dealing with a family dispute. But there actually were training bulletins in the 1940s dealing with persons with a mental illness. And I found that interesting because the reality is the role in law enforcement, while it's shifted through time, it's always been there. Society has always leaned on the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week responders, whether it be paramedics or law enforcement. But it really changed when the LPS Act came into law because then it made it statutory. And what I mean by that is in California, only law enforcement professionals or individuals designated by the directors of the departments of mental health for those particular counties have the authority to actually take somebody involuntarily for a psychiatric examination. So there's a statutory component to it. But then I think society slipped to where they became dependent on that, as opposed to being prevention-minded, looking at, doing community outreach and educating people. 911 became the norm. Sergeant Lopez, who was a sergeant who worked for me 5 years ago when he did his master's dissertation, he found that the African-American community in Los Angeles disproportionately accessed mental health services through the 911 system. Well, who teaches communities to use 911? The government, providers. So education is extremely important in that aspect. Calls for service have expanded just in the 15 years that I was doing it, the 30 years I was on the department. They've become more acute. I think there's a lot of societal factors that play into that. I think even with the Mental Health Services Act, which provided funding for a lot of these programs, there was an inability to use it appropriately to do that outreach and to really shift the burden from the 911 and emergency services because that was just convenient. So I saw the calls increase. I saw the severity of the calls. I think people became more dependent on law enforcement. And as Sergeant Lopez said in his master's thesis, we became the gatekeepers to mental health services and providers for not only the county, but this is nationally, and actually it's internationally. The problem exists there. So I'm seeing a shift now, and I'm hoping that shift continues.
So just to make sure I understand, is what you've seen is that sort of in lieu of ongoing treatment that might prevent a psychiatric crisis, there had been a shift with to using 911 and using short-term hospitalizations perhaps as treatment rather than treatment that might prevent them from getting to that point?
Agree with that 100%. I think we've created a situation where it's become a perfect storm, and we've created situations where not always are you going to get a trained officer or a trained paramedic firefighter who's going to come in and be able to manage and deal with that situation, which makes it ripe for negative outcomes. And it traumatizes not only the individual in crisis but the families because we've kind of told them when you need help, call 911, but that's not really the way they should be accessing mental health services. We should be in the sequential intercept model when they first made that, where they talked about how a person progresses through the criminal justice system. What they didn't talk about was Intercept Zero, where we should be dealing with them in the community as opposed to dealing with that first law enforcement contact.
That's really interesting. I hadn't actually conceptualized it that way. So that's some pretty remarkable food for thought. And one of my soapbox positions has always been we need more prevention and early intervention. But I hadn't really thought about how families were using 911 as sort of a first recourse rather than a latter recourse. And maybe there's some education that needs to go around that. So that's really interesting. LAPD has perhaps the best model of a SMART program, certainly one of the best. I was very impressed when I was there. For our listeners, SMART is a system-wide mental assessment response team where uniformed officers are partnered with a mental health professional to respond to and link people in crisis to resources or to perhaps hospitalize them if that's what they need. But Charles, from your perspective, having been in this truly model program, can you talk to us a little bit about the pros and cons of a SMART model response for the mentally ill?
Well, so there's two basic programs that are accepted nationally as best practice. One is the crisis intervention team model, one where an officer or paramedic firefighter receives 40 hours of intensive training to familiarize them and provide them tools in order to deal with individuals in crisis and families in crisis, and also teaches them about community resources, trying to link those family members. But, you know, these are generally law enforcement-based responses, and there's not a community response, which is more similar to what the SMART model is, which is a co-responder model. SMART teams a clinician and a specially trained officer together to respond to crisis and calls for service. And the beauty of that is it goes across both spectrums, where we have the mental health portion and any criminal justice portion addressed at the exact same time. And we're working at a perspective that we're there to provide the individual with a holistic intervention, you know, treat the whole person, right? See what's going on, treat the family and deal with the family members and get them linked to services, which is a little bit different than the CIT model. The challenge is resources. Let's be honest. We only have 17 teams in a 24-hour period. The sheriffs have similar numbers for a county of 10 million. Long Beach has a fantastic program. But let's be honest, we would do a much better job if we were responding to the real true crisis where there was a situation where there was a potential threat towards an individual or others, but not somebody who's just suicidal, right? When I say just suicidal, somebody who's making a cry out for help. And in fact, Dee Hirsch and many of the crisis call centers will tell you that 98% of those are handled in-house. They never have to involve emergency services. Yeah, the resources are something that is challenging. Not only do the SMART teams respond to calls, we do follow-up. But again, LA's 4 million, LA County's 10 million. The resources are very, very thin when it comes to that crisis response.
So sort of follow-up to something you said is, it struck me, and I want to make sure I understand correctly, that with the co-partner, the LAPD SMART model, where it's an officer and a therapist, the role of the officer, is it for in case there's sort of a criminal element to the interaction, or is it for safety? Like, what's the sort of philosophical position behind the pairing, I guess?
Well, what you see is because it's a 911 call for service, so generally you're going to have other first responders there. The officer is a go-between with the uniformed officers who might be at scene already or might be investing a criminal complaint. And the clinician is there to delve into the background of the individual. We might even be looking at the criminal justice background of the individual, see if they've already been criminally justice involved. So we're getting the whole picture. And frankly, when we started the program, we started going to court with these individuals who became engaged in the criminal justice system. The judges liked it because they got the whole picture. So we have a behavioral issue here along with the criminal issue. How can we best manage John or Sue or Jose so they can get better so they don't have to be re-engaged with the criminal justice system. So it's very holistic. It really does a fantastic job. And I frequently find a lot of the officers, you'll find we have clinical social workers, we have officers with degrees in psychology. It draws a special person to this job, or they have family members themselves who are suffering with a mental illness. So you're bringing true specialists into these situations. And because of the repetition of the calls, so a uniformed officer might see one or two of these or three of these over a couple-day period, they're going to 2 and 3 and 4 calls a day. So they become very familiar with the individuals, the communities, and then the systems that support them. So it's a very more holistic intervention.
That makes sense. And I was struck by that during our collaborations when we worked with your team, how many of them were actually in graduate school becoming clinicians while they were still doing their law enforcement work, and what an empathic approach that was. I was, again, really impressed by that. So you touched on the issue of resources. So I did read on the LAPD website that LAPD has 17 SMART teams. And like you said, given the size and population of Los Angeles, I have to believe that a majority of these calls are still taken by patrol officers. And I know you've dedicated at least the latter part of your career trying to ensure that all these officers and beyond are appropriately trained to handle these encounters. But at the same time, they're pulled in countless directions on the job. So given all these demands, I'm just curious what you think. Are we doing the right thing expecting police to manage these calls, or is it an unfair burden on law enforcement?
You know, you can ask anybody who works a unit or who is in law enforcement. We'd rather be out of the business of dealing with individuals, or not just dealing, but responding to these types of calls, because we do believe we're not always the most appropriate person there. And we believe that we could, it would be better if we developed alternate systems in order to address these calls for service, so that you didn't need to dispatch uniformed officers to these calls. When I left, we were about 70% to 80% of our hospitalizations were being handled by SMART teams, which is pretty good. But the benefit is we're not always hospitalizing everybody. We're developing safety plans. We're working with the families. We're seeing if the individual has a provider. A uniformed officer is not going to have that information. So, I would love to see a day that for mental health type calls for service where there is no threat to the public or immediate safety issues, that law enforcement was not the first phone call or the first response mechanism to these calls.
Does that opinion change, or do you feel any differently if it's a child that's in crisis?
I believe especially children. Two of the things that I looked at when I first came to the unit was I looked at the elderly, the developmentally disabled, and children. Because not only are you now looking at individuals who may be in crisis, but they're extremely vulnerable. So we changed things like with children, we use ambulances for transport, so we treat it more medical. Then you traditionally see one of the things I was on the phone with the Southern Poverty Law Center was that they transport all the kids in police cars. That's what they know in Florida. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. That's what they're mandated and dictated to do, because in that state it's a shell. But in California it's a may, and we have options. I see that the Department of Mental Health, and I see when we request EMS or firefighters, we never get balked at when it's a child or an elderly person or person with disabilities, because they understand that that's a special need type thing and it requires an extra level of care on our part.
That makes sense. I have to confess, and I mean this very respectfully, those were about the children it was, but in general, that wasn't necessarily the answer I expected from you, that you would like to be out of this business, simply because your department, I think, does dedicate quite a lot of resources to this. So I think it takes a degree of humility to say, yeah, but all that work we did, it would be great if we didn't have to do it anymore.
That's typical of law enforcement or first responders in general. And I go across the board. We're fixers, right? So we have a problem that's out there that's not being addressed or not being taken care of. So we feel we have to fix the problem. We have to be there to make it correct. I don't know if it's humility or common sense, but I do not believe that if we had an opportunity to interject another type of a response model, that law enforcement shouldn't be the first phone call.
I don't think we can fairly address this topic without acknowledging the pressures police departments and city governments are under right now, following the murder of George Floyd and calls to defund the police. In the context of conversations about rethinking the role of law enforcement, there seems to be an increasing interest in changing how we manage nonviolent psychiatric calls. It is an interesting evolution, given that Mr. Floyd's police interaction was unrelated to mental illness, but one that has been embraced by both mental health and law enforcement advocates. They see new political receptiveness to reevaluating law enforcement as an opportunity to create change they've long been seeking. Brian Marvel, president of Peace Officers Research Association of California, said, "With city budgets and the societal ills we face, it all gets dumped on police." He sees the current environment as an opportunity to promote his position that police should not be first responders to mental health calls. The CAHOOTS program in Oregon is getting a hard look as a potential national model. CAHOOTS, which stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets, is a program that diverts emergency and non-emergency calls involving mental illness away from the police to a nonprofit organization, Whitebird Clinic. The clinic operates with teams of two, an EMT and a mental health paraprofessional, who are able to respond without police intervention or a licensed therapist. The program was established in 1989 as a collaboration between police, fire, and the Whitebird Clinic. It has grown to support two Oregon cities and manage as many as 65 calls a day. The model is being considered for replication in major cities nationally. Advocates point out that the mentally ill are not criminals, and perhaps a police response isn't needed. Or perhaps we are expecting too much of our police to ask them to function as therapists as well as officers. You know, I was reading that San Francisco, famous for their issues with homeless mentally ill right now, unfortunately infamous, I should say, is one city that is replacing police officers with unarmed mental health professionals to respond to non-criminal cases involving mental illness. And I read, too, that the San Francisco police chief, William Scott's, fully in support of this. And I read too, or I understand that I think LAPD is exploring similar pilot programs with some of the local nonprofits. So, you know, as someone like you who's worked so effectively with a different model, what do you think of this new direction of sort of replicating the CAHOOTS program?
So, let's frame the topic. San Francisco is a different animal than Los Angeles. In Los Angeles, we have a very strong, cohesive relationship with our Los Angeles Department of Mental Health, whereas in San Francisco, the law enforcement component and the mental health providers were at odds all the time. So there wasn't always a collaborative response to these types of calls for service. Chief Scott came from Los Angeles. He knows what we do down here and what we've been involved in. So, and he's a very forward-thinking individual. So I agree with him. Non-criminal, no safety involved. Not all crises are equal, right? That's not all crises are equal, and each one requires a different type of response. So yes, we are looking at doing that. I know that one of the things they started was initially was with the fire department, a nurse practitioner response unit. And then they call them advanced provider units. They keep changing the name. But basically what it is a paramedic, and either a nurse practitioner or a PA, a physician's assistant, who can engage out in the street individuals, homeless individuals who are in crises. They can do the medical clearance there, and then they can take them to a crisis stabilization center instead of a hospital. That's a much, much more effective way of dealing with the individual. They're not going through two sets of admissions. They're getting right to where they need to be in order to manage the crisis. And they can also, you know, if diabetes or whatever needs to be addressed, they can be taken care of there. Tucson has a fantastic program, same with San Antonio, no wrong door, when it comes to individuals in mental health crisis, but they also treat the whole person. So they're looking at the medical conditions along with the psychiatric conditions. Cahoots works for Eugene, but I'm going to tell you, Cahoots does not work or will not work for Los Angeles. It won't work for Denver. It won't work for San Francisco. They're basically a homeless outreach team. I've talked to them in depth, the folks over at the Whitebird Clinic. I've talked to the Eugene Police Department. Fantastic program. It's funded out of the police department. It's kind of smart. But they do very low-level street engagements. If you look at their numbers, their average engagement, if their numbers are solid, which is something I'm very in tune to. I like to make sure our statistics match up with what we're saying. Their engagements are very short. So 10, 15 minute, maybe they're handing out some hygiene supplies, talking to them about referral resources, providing them basic medical care in the street. We have things like that in Los Angeles, Step Up on Second. We have nurse practitioners and clinical providers who actually go out and engage individuals in the setting within which they're living. So, I'm not sure. I know when the city council passed the motion on the Cahoots, I'm not really sure they were educated enough to understand that we have psychiatric mobile response teams. Now, the challenge is dispatch. So if I'm in crisis, I call 911. Is that going to dispatch a psychiatric mobile response team? And even if it did, could they get there in a timely fashion? No, the answer is going to be no. So alternate models are fantastic. We need to cut down on the number of 911 calls that are being diverted to first responders, crisis responders. Crisis counseling over the phone has worked for a very long time. I think we're working in that direction right now to mitigate some of those suicidal calls where there's no threat of violence and really save the SMART teams or the first responders for those true calls that are involving the safety, not only of the individual, but the community.
So that's really interesting. So Cahoots does not in the same way respond to a true psychiatric crisis. It's in some ways more preventative sort of work. Well, preventative, the people are already homeless, but preventing a crisis that might result in a hospitalization or an incident of some sort.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is one of the questions I asked them, because recidivism or repeat calls regarding the same individual, we have our super users in Los Angeles, Long Beach has super users, you know, all communities have super users of psychiatric and medical services. So I asked the individuals at Whitebird Clinic, I asked, so how do you track these individuals so you know, was your intervention effective, or did you provide them most appropriate referral, or where you took them was the most appropriate for them if it was housing, and they don't track anything. So then I became, I won't say suspect, but I became concerned that while we're putting great emphasis on Cahoots, which I think does a fantastic job for Eugene, we know that we need to make sure that if I refer somebody to housing, refer somebody to whatever their needs are, that there's going to be some linkage. And if I'm not tracking or, you know, following up on that information, then if another team member comes behind me, they won't know. And we'll be recycling the same problem. So there's some challenges, I think, that we need to address. But I really don't think a Cahoots model, we already have it here. We have Volunteers of America. They all do a lot of the similar things that Cahoots does up in Eugene. They don't have the resources that LA County has, not even close, or Long Beach or any of these other major municipalities.
I understand. So you know, one of the things, and you touched on this a little bit as well, you know, the different models. There's a SMART model, there's training your officers well, there's a CAHOOTS type program, but it's still clear that so many of our major cities just are not getting ahead of the problem of mental illness. Just, you know, we read the data about children's mental health right now, the increase in children's suicidality, and homeless encampments across our cities, Long Beach, Los Angeles, seems everywhere you turn. And, you know, I'm wondering, with all this energy around management of a psychiatric crisis and law enforcement's role in that, are we focusing our energies in the right place? And I ask this because I think you've seen better than anyone sort of that vicious, repetitive cycle with crisis after crisis that's endured by our mentally ill. So is this the right place to be putting our energies, our reform energies?
I think everybody's trying to do the right thing, but it's just not in a truly collaborative, coordinated model. Even within the Department of Mental Health, you have different service areas who have different directors, and each one has a different vision on how things should be managed in their area of responsibility. In Arizona, and not because it's my new home state, but they have a network called Crisis Now. No, I've not seen it. I've read a lot about it. But basically, it works like an air traffic control system where you have one number you call, no matter where you are in the state, and then that center then either addresses if it needs to be just a crisis on the phone counseling session, or they need to dispatch law enforcement, or they need to dispatch crisis responders, you know, non-law enforcement to a non-criminal matter. Dr. Sharon came out, who's a director of the Department of Mental Health, came out and looked at that, spoke to them. But I think he's dealing with a lot of political pull back and forth between the Board of Supervisors and the different cities. But I truly think that if we were able to develop something like that in the county of Los Angeles, you know, nobody's going to dial a 10-digit number when they're in crisis. The 3-digit numbers are simple. But if even if they did dial that 911, that they'd be able to then divert that call to like a Crisis Now or an air traffic control that says, this is the most appropriate response to this particular type of crisis. You know, what's that old saying, you know, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? Right. So it's the same thing, right? I mean, if we don't change how we perceive the initial call for service to begin with, and I know that Lieutenant Manise and the folks over at the mayor's office, we actually worked for 3 years trying to get funding for a 911 diversion to D.D. Hirsch. And we couldn't find funding. The feds didn't want to fund us. The county didn't want to fund us. And finally, we got through the Mayor's Innovation and Performance Commission. We got a grant to fund this, but it just makes common sense. You're not going to have a bad law enforcement outcome if we're not responding to that call, that is being managed by a mental health professional or a person who's specifically trained to deal with an individual in crisis. So I think we just need to be more cohesive in our response. And not worry so much about our silos and our little fiefdoms.
Other than that, are there any additional barriers you think would need to be addressed to break this cycle?
Change the laws. Boy, I can tell you, I've been on many a phone call, both nationally and at different states and also in California, where if it's statutory that law enforcement shall or must respond to these type of calls, or they're the only individuals who have the power because we don't have somebody who's designated as an LPS provider, we're not going to change the way things are going. And they need to fund it, and they need to fund it appropriately so that if we decide that a CAHOOTS model is appropriate for this community, that the funding streams are there and they're not going through the different political loopholes that we find in all of this that what we have to deal with, and make sure that the statutes support these type of programs so they're not just boutique programs that'll disappear with the funding.
So, you know, it's been hard, I think, even, You know, I'm sort of an eternal optimist, and I've spent my career in the area of mental health, but seeing sort of what's around us, the, as I said, the homeless encampments, the really alarming increase in children's suicidality. Are there any unexpected bright sides that you see right now? What still gives you hope? You're clearly still an advocate. You're clearly still invested. What still gives you optimism?
I don't know if you know Linda Boyd, but Linda Boyd started this journey with me years and years ago. She was a program manager for the Department of Mental Health. We were presenting in Boston. It was one of our first presentations on our CAMP model, which is a case assessment management program, which is the follow-up component to individuals in crisis. And we did our presentation, and one of the individuals in front, and I could tell he was a researcher. He goes, "Well, Detective Dempsey, this all sounds wonderful and fine." He goes, "But do you have statistics, and do you have something that can demonstrate the efficacy of the program? Does it really, really work?" And what I thought for a second, and I looked at the individual, and I said, "I judge success one individual at a time. I know there's a responsibility for us to look at it holistically and look at the bigger picture, but I've seen thousands upon thousands of individuals who've been engaged and whose lives have changed in the positive direction because of an interaction by one of our teams or one of our officers who's been trained, known to refer the individual for further follow-up afterwards." So, I do think there's hope as long as there's individuals who are willing to invest themselves in trying to make things better. We're not going to change all the politicians. We have advocates every once in a while. But the reality is it's going to be individuals like you and your folks on the ground doing it day in and day out. When you make that one connection, that changes the trajectory of that individual, that child, or that family, that makes it all worthwhile.
Thank you for that. Is there anything you want to add that I haven't touched on, or do you feel like we've covered the most important points here?
Yeah, I just want to thank you for asking me to do this. I think the most important thing is we can't help others be well unless we're well ourselves. So as bosses or individuals who are leaders in this endeavor, we need to make sure that the folks who work with us and work around us are staying healthy also, because this can be a drain on them emotionally and affect them also. So self-checks are really important. So self-check to each of you. I think this is a wonderful opportunity, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. It's really nice to see you again. We've always enjoyed our interactions, and I definitely know you are an advocate the message of self-care. So I appreciate that as well. Thank you for sharing your insights and your experiences as a leader in both law enforcement and mental health. I really believe you have just a vitally important voice on these issues, and this has been really interesting. You've left me with really great food for thought. So thank you. And be well in your retirement.
Thank you. See, the hair is getting long.
I saw that. That's nice.
Right, good seeing you all. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And be well. Stay safe, guys.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
What we've highlighted today is the incredible challenges cities and police departments face in addressing and mitigating mental health emergencies in real time. We've increasingly tasked police with mental health interventions for which they're not always trained. The resources necessary to create effective mental evaluation teams within police departments are considerable. We're thankfully talking more openly about mental health and the role of first responders. Ideally, we can create systems that don't place officers in the untenable position of assuming a role for which they're not equipped, or the mentally ill in a position where their illness is criminalized, or more frightening, where the system places both parties at risk of an adverse outcome. It's my position that by shining a light on these issues, admitting that they are in our own backyards, it will be easier for a struggling child to get some help. Ideally, we can all begin to be kinder and more supportive of each other.
In My Backyard is brought to you by the Guidance Center. a children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California. In My Backyard is produced by Tricia Costales and Matthew Murray. Production assistance provided by Julie Ruano. Thank you to J. Vincent B. for original music. All other music licensed through Soundstripe. Thank you to our listeners and supporters. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Subscribe to In My Backyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.